Well, last week was so long ago. Can anyone remember something that we discussed in the last few days? What was the topic? Janam, did you have your hand up?
Yeah.
Bolo?
Bolie? So we were talking about this progression of purification of the yoga ladder.
Okay.
From chapter 3, from karma. From jnana to karma, acting with attachment, sakkam karma, but offering some of the results to Krishna, and this way making it transcendental.
Okay, next, someone else.
I was going to say how
we have in that chapter.
You have to speak loudly if you're facing me, and I can do this so easily and it's so sweet. Why take this opportunity from the other?
We use the various verses in the third chapter as a guide of how to preach to people.
Yeah, open element time.
Also, specifically, the issue of the importance of engaging people in practical service.
Anything else, James?
Well, learning how to engage somebody according to where they're at.
Yeah.
If someone's attached to a spanner and he's dubbed them from telling them to announce everything.
Why? Why is there no point?
Because internally his attachment will still be there, but it's been artificial renunciation, and he won't be able to maintain his position.
What? Is there any way that someone could maintain their position?
If they engage all the material attachments and the material responsibilities within the service.
If they have deep faith and if they're surrendered. If someone has deep faith and they're surrendered, they can jump from here to here immediately. That is by the mercy of Guru. But it is like... This, in case you haven't figured it out, is a great... This is a mountain over here and a mountain over here, and we want to get from this side to this side. And we have so many attachments, and we want to cross to the side of no attachment. So we can take the longer route, in one sense, by taking the gradual process, and that's what Krishna really recommends. But there are dangers in that in Kali Yuga, because material life is such a dark well that once you enter in, those material attachments, rather than becoming satisfied, can easily get completely lost. So the spiritual master, our spiritual master, throws a rope over to us. So if we're very, very strongly holding on to that rope so tightly and have so great faith, that he'll pull us right across and save us so much time. But as he's pulling us, and we're holding on, and we think, oh no, what about my mother and my father and my cat, and who's going to take care of me when I'm old, and I have this inheritance that's coming, and this and that, and we think so many things, and then we, oh no! So when we're young, we tend to hold on very tightly in the beginning because we don't know anything. We don't know what's happening. And then as we get a little older, we start thinking, oh no, what have I done, maybe? So it's very tricky. It's a very big responsibility to be a spiritual master and to be a guide, because you want to give the person the medicine that he can digest and he can assimilate, and it will make him stronger. But the main thing is somebody's faith. And if someone has that faith and holds on tight enough, then he can be pulled right across and up. No wasting time. And if one is, of course, pure enough to hold on. Also, sometimes people sort of have faith, but they say, but wait, I have to go back in because of attachments. We're going to be discussing that in a moment, in one sense. But first, what I wanted to do is just finish a section continuing this progression in the fifth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And then we'll do another part today that's also very, very interesting. We'll go back in the Gita a little bit to the end of the third chapter. But we've heard how the mode of ignorance is symptomized by people unrestrained and unrestricted in how they're attempting to fulfill their desires. That's the mode of ignorance. There is no regulation, there is no restriction. That is material life today. No restriction, it doesn't make any difference. If it feels good, if you want to do it, that's the only requirement. But then, someone, even if he has material desires, adopts the rules and regulations for enjoying himself. That's the mode of passion. And just by that acceptance of authority, and accepting that I can't enjoy it without someone's blessings, that will elevate him to some degree. But when he understands that there is a spiritual goal to it all, then it becomes yoga. Before that, if he's just following a religious system to enjoy, it's not actually yoga. What is it? It's just some material piety, where people just want to get higher in the material world. It's actually worth nothing spiritually, because you have to come down again. But soon as one establishes as his goal the transcendent, even if it is Brahman, or if it is Paramatma, or if it is Bhagwan, then that is yoga, because it's the linking with the transcendental. So in the beginning, when one has material desires, he engages his material desires in Krishna's service. He does what he wants to do, and he gives something to Krishna. And by doing that, he develops detachment, his passion is diminished, he comes up to the platform of goodness. And in that platform of goodness, he's still attached to his work, working in a particular way. But he's not attached to the fruit of his work, so he's on the platform of duty. Then, by working on the platform of duty, this working as one is obliged, but throughout the ups and downs of life, just remaining steady and never attached to the fruit, the result of that is one gets transcendental knowledge. Now, in the fifth chapter, page 286, text 12, we're going to read beginning over there. Text 12 summarizes this principle. The steadily devoted soul attains unadulterated peace because he offers the result of all activities to me. So we've discussed that. What is that called? What's the Sanskrit term? When one does his duty and then offers the fruit of one's work to Krishna. What is that called? One offers the fruit of his work all to Krishna. Nishkam. With no material desire. He's just working and giving everything to Krishna. And that's really no different from bhakti, because it will lead very quickly to actual devotion, which begins with surrender. But on the other hand, there's that person who is offering something to Krishna. And on the other hand, a person who is not in union with the divine, who is greedy for the fruits of his labor, he becomes entangled in fruitive activities. Next verse. This is what happens when one works on the Nishkam platform and offers everything especially to Krishna. If one just is detached, he may become elevated in Brahman realization. If one is offering it to Krishna, same detachment is there, but there is an attachment to Krishna, then he will attain gradually Krishna. This is a description of the gradual process as it's continuing. When the embodied living being controls his nature and mentally renounces all actions, this is very deep. He resides happily in the city of nine gates, the material body, neither working nor causing work to be done. In other words, what's happening is by working in a detached fashion, one begins to understand that he is not his body. And he begins to feel complete detachment from his body. And therefore he realizes that the body is working and he has a nature and he has a particular tendency. But actually he, the identity, the soul, that consciousness, that feeling me, has nothing to do with either the work or the tendencies. One is because he's completely aloof. He's a soul. He's beginning to realize that. So he's neither working or causing work to be done. It's all his body and his mind. So then, text 14. The embodied spirit, master of the city of the body. He is not the body, he is the master of the body. He is the predominator of the body. He is the kshetrajna. He is the knower of his field of activities, but he is not the field of activities. Any more than when we walk into this room, we become the room. We are in the room. But we are not the room. So to experience the difference between ourselves and the body, our body is what occurs here. So the embodied spirit, master of the city of his body, he does not create activities. He is not the one doing it. Nor does he induce other people to act. Nor does he create the fruits of action. All this is enacted by the modes of material nature. So he's actually experiencing himself aloof, separate from his body. Just like if we're driving the car very fast, our car. How many of you drive? Raise your hand if you're experienced drivers of cars. Okay. So sometimes when everything is working really well in the car and you're going so fast, and as soon as you put your foot on the gas pedal, it happens automatically. You turn the wheel and it goes. You start thinking it's you, practically speaking. You say, I'm going so fast now. How fast am I going? And you look at the speedometer. How fast am I going? We start thinking like that. So similarly, we've been, ever since we can remember, we're identifying with the body. We've been growing up and the body's been growing up and we identify with the body. But actually, we have nothing to do with the body. So such a self-realized soul, he realizes that because he's not his body, all his interactions with people are just the modes of material nature. He's not creating his abilities. I'm thinking I'm an American, I'm 47, I'm this, I'm that. But this doesn't have anything to do with me, actually. I'm eternal. I push you, but this isn't me getting angry at you. All this is just the modes of material nature, prakriti, just working in this world, the forces of material nature. So he's beginning to detach himself through to this purification that comes from working without not fruitively beginning to experience that he's completely separate from the body, that he is the symptom of him is consciousness, and his consciousness is permeating the body. But he has nothing to do with it. Then it's an interesting point how this verse explains that all this is done by the modes of material nature. But the modes of material nature, they are mechanical. They are inert. They don't have life. They are controlled by Krishna. So in one sense, Krishna as Sarvakarana Karanam, the cause of all causes, he's the one. He's saying here that it's being done by the modes of material nature, but actually he's the one behind the modes of material nature. But even though he's behind it, just like if I, just like when, yes, that's what I was thinking of doing. I can't remember the exact, I'm thinking of an example with the Gurukula boys. You know, sometimes when you're with the Gurukula boys, one of them will hit another boy. And you say, why did you do that? I didn't do it. My hand did it. So immediately you bring him over and you pick up his stick and I didn't do it, the stick did it, you know, what's the difference? Something like that. So Krishna is that, so you can say when you do something sinful, It's like one time I was in Hong Kong when I was preaching to a very wealthy man, young man, and he had looked, read the Bhagavad Gita a little bit, and he was very proud and very, very foolish. So he was smoking a cigarette. So I said, "Why are you smoking?" He said, "I'm not smoking, it's just my body." The stick comes out, "I'm not hitting you, it's just a stick." So it's such nothing. So, and then you could say, well, if Krishna didn't want me to smoke, how could I smoke? Not a blade of grass moves. If Krishna doesn't want me to put a knife in you, how can I do it? After all, the modes of material nature are working. I'm not, and Krishna's behind that. I'm not doing any. Kartahamiti manyate. I'm not the doer. So someone could say that. A cheater with that mentality can say that. So therefore Krishna says in text 15, even though ultimately, even though the verse doesn't say this, but it's implied, even though ultimately Krishna is the cause of all causes, and he is the one who's directing the modes of material nature, but nor does the Supreme Lord assume anyone's sinful or pious activities. Embodied beings, however, are bewildered because of the ignorance that covers their real knowledge. So Krishna is samoham sarvabhuteshu. He is equal to all living entities. He's the upadrasta, the anumanta. He is the permitter and the overseer. And he's allowing it to go on, just like in prison. Or someone robs a bank. And they put him in jail. And then you ask him, why are you in jail? And he says, because the police brought me to the jail. Now, yes, it's true that he's in jail because the police brought him to jail and the judge sentenced him. But the real reason he's in jail is because he robbed the bank. So we don't like to think about what we did. We blame it on the enforcement agency. And the judge, he is impartial. So Krishna is like the judge. And the material energy enforces the judgments. That's property. But it's the living entities who, by their actions, get sinful and pious reactions. Even though they are not capable of doing on their own, but yet it is due to their desires and their attempt that gets them the reactions in the modes of material nature. That makes them the doers, even though they're not the complete doer. It's a very interesting philosophical point. But the living entity, so Krishna, even though Krishna says clearly, Prakriti Kriyamanani, Gunayakamani Sarvasha, that the living entity isn't the doer. But yet, how funny it is that the living entity gets the reaction for his activities, even though he's not the doer. So it almost doesn't sound fair in one sense. But because they're desiring to do, and Krishna's satisfying their desires, and they're trying their best to do, therefore they get the reaction that Krishna is neutral, involved in this. So the living entities, while all this is going on, just like a little boy, if there's, say if there's some weights down here, and there's a big, strong weightlifter, so he picks up the weights, 5,000 million pounds, and he puts it down. And he's so powerful. And then his little son walks over to him and says, "Oh, my father lifted that up." So therefore he gets down. He's just a little boy, he can't lift anything. So he gets down and he goes, and the father sees him. So he says, "Okay, I'll help him." So the father actually does all the work, and the little boy goes like this. And the father is the one carrying all the weight, and then he puts it down. So, who is doing it? If it wasn't for the boy's attempt, it would never happen. So in that sense, he's doing it. There wouldn't be any reason for his father to lift it unless the boy lifted. But it's not the boy who's doing it, on the other hand. Right? Because he has no capacity to do it on his own. It's due to his father actually doing it, but it's due to the boy and his desire and his attempt. So that's our situation. And we have to get the reaction, even though we're not the ultimate doer, because we can't do anything. We're so tiny and insignificant. But because we're attempting, Krishna as the super soul allows everything to go on. So we, like the little boy thinking, I'm so powerful now, I can lift 1,000, 2,000 pounds, just look what I've done. We are like that, thinking we're so powerful. So therefore, because we're in so much illusion, thinking that we're so powerful, Krishna says, kartaham iti manyate. Those who are bewildered think that they're doing it. Even though it is them doing it, but Krishna preaches in that way because we're bewildered and we think we're doing everything. So what is it? We are bewildered. Now this verse is important and will lead to the next section. The living entities are bewildered because of ignorance, that is avidya, which covers their real knowledge. Now what is the knowledge that ignorance covers? I'm depending upon what ultimately it covers, that I'm Krishna's eternal servant, and even more ultimately it covers our actual relationship with Krishna. But the covering is, I'm thinking, I am the doer, I am powerful, balan sukhi, I'm happy, I'm so wonderful, you know, just see this, you are my enemy, watch out. So many things. This is all the maya, the illusion, the ignorance is covering the living entity. So many other identities other than I'm Krishna's and Krishna is mine. This is actually Krishna consciousness. Thinking I am Krishna's and Krishna is mine. This is Krishna consciousness. Any other thinking who we are and what is ours is called maya, is influenced by ignorance or maya. I am Krishna's and Krishna is mine. That is Krishna consciousness. So ignorance covers the living entity who is bewildered. Now in the next verse relates to, so that ignorance is removed by the process that we've been discussing, by giving everything to Krishna. I'm working. And because Krishna is the one who's actually doing it, he's actually lifting everything, I'm giving everything to him. That is the realization that's coming. And then the result of that is you get out of ignorance that's covering our real knowledge, and we realize in text 16, when however one is enlightened with the knowledge, what is the knowledge? That I am Krishna, I'm just a tiny soul, I have nothing to do with the body, so I'm going to use this body in Krishna's service because it really belongs to him as does everything else. Then, when one is enlightened by knowledge by which nescience is destroyed, ignorance is destroyed by seeing that I'm a soul, then this knowledge reveals everything as the sun lights up everything in the daytime. So in other words, this is actually prior to the knowledge I'm just mentioning, but it's knowledge, understanding, the gradual understanding is I am not my body, I am a soul. And then ignorance is gone. The prime ignorance is identification with the body. And we're so attached to this body. So attached. We identify with our family, with our country. When we have a headache, I have a headache. When we're feeling healthy, I am so healthy. Complete identification with the body. This is the root ignorance and the root intoxication. So this is the result, this verse 16 is the result of this Nishkam Karma Yoga, is that we realize that we are not our body. And then in the next verse brings us to the next step. So this is knowledge, and the next step, 17, is liberation. So knowledge, knowing we're not our body, actually isn't liberation. And Jiva Goswami just actually describes this in the Sandarbhas, and Prabhupada mentions it so many places, that liberation is dependent on devotional service. Devotional service is svatantra, independent. And devotional service doesn't depend on jnana or anything, but success in jnana and karma and liberation ultimately depends on bhakti. Devotional service. So in this verse describes this, how to get from the point of view in this yoga ladder we're talking about, how to get from the point of view of of gyan, or not knowing that you're not your body, to liberation. When one's intelligence, mind, faith, and refuge are all fixed in the Supreme, in other words, when we start focusing on Krishna, either in the form of Brahman, Paramatma, or Bhagavan, then one becomes fully cleansed of misgivings through complete knowledge. The knowledge is complete then, and thus proceeds straight on the path of liberation. Then one is liberated. And depending upon what your goal is and how deep your knowledge of what the Supreme is, then you get one type of liberation or another. You either go to Brahman, or you go to Paramatma, or you go to Bhagavan, either Vaikuntha or Krishna Loka. Very scientific. So when one, at this point especially, this is the jnani that in the seventh chapter where Krishna will say that such a jnani who comes to me is so dear to me. This is what Krishna is talking about here. One who comes to the point of jnana and then focuses on him. Because he's detached from all matter, he becomes so dear to Krishna. Because it's all, it's practically speaking love, because he doesn't want anything from Krishna. Then in the next verse, it describes, and this verse is interesting, there's an interesting twist on it. Vidyavinaya sampane brahmani gavi hastini suni chaiva sopake cha pandita samadarshana. So with that, once one gets liberated, that means, it can mean a few things. If you are a jnani, it will mean that you see Brahman everywhere, in everyone, that everyone is a soul. If you're a paramatmavadi, a yogi, you will see that the paramatma is in everyone's heart, like that. So a humble sage, by virtue of true knowledge, sees with equal vision a learned and a gentle brahmana, a cow, an elephant, a dog, and a dog eater. So the sage, with his knowledge, when he looks at any living entity, he sees their equality. He doesn't see the differences in their body. He sees them all as spirit souls, or he sees them as having the paramatma in their heart. So this sage, getting this liberation, sees everyone has the paramatma in everyone's heart. And therefore, even when someone slaps us, we can understand that Krishna has sanctioned that. That's how we should look at it, for our purification. If Krishna didn't sanction it, how could it happen? So Krishna wants me slapped, so I'm getting slapped. And this way, when we see Krishna in all these activities, there is no enmity between living entities. The interesting twist on this, where one can understand this in a different way, a higher knowledge, also, when one has knowledge, panditya sama darshana, one can understand sama. The pandit has equal vision, that he has vision of sama, equality. So there's another meaning of that, that I think it's maybe Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explained. Sa in Sanskrit means with, and ma can means Lakshmi Devi. So who is with Lakshmi Devi?
Narayan.
So someone who has that type of vision, that purity, who is a devotee, a bhakta, he will see everywhere, he will see Lakshmi and Narayan. Everyone's heart will see that equality, he will see Lord Narayan. Or, Ma can also be Srimati Radharani, and who is with Srimati Radharani, but Shyama Sundar. So a person who has that vision, Premanjana Charita Bhakti Valo Chalena, Santa Sadaya Vridhi Shubhalokayati Yam Shyama Sundaram Achintya Gunasarupam Govinda Mari Purusham Tamaham Vijayam. So a person with that vision, with Prema Bhakti within his heart, everywhere he looks, he will see Shyama Sundar. Sama. Okay. So any questions? Good. We'll go on to the next one. There's no questions. Because...
Can we go back
now? Oh yes, let's go back. We'll We'll have questions right at the end. But what time the end will be, so it's very, very interesting how this process, you know, can bring us, you know, just simply by doing your duties according to higher authority, detached from the food, offering everything to Krishna, first a little detachment, then complete detachment, then giving everything to Krishna, and then giving everything with love. We can realize everything and see Krishna in everyone's heart, Radha Shyamasundar in everyone's heart. This comes from what? Doing our duties. And what is the result of doing our duties on all these different levels is we attain these very high stages of consciousness. And what is removed, we just heard, what is removed by this type of Krishna consciousness, increasing Krishna consciousness, is the bewilderment or ignorance that covers everyone's heart, making us think that we're the doer, we're so powerful, so many false identities. So then in text 36 of the third chapter, Arjuna asks a question that really pertains to not only the third chapter, but to all the steps on the process. So we're very inspired now. We're going to go and do detached work, nishkam karma, and offer everything to Krishna. But yet, and we saw it in the Krishna consciousness movement, so many devotees, they join young, enthusiastic, and so many devotees left. What makes people, even though they become convinced and so fired up, and we get inspired, here's the ladder, I'm going to cross the steps of the, I'm going to climb all the way up. Now what is it? Arjuna asks a very intelligent question. What is it that forces one to jump off the ladder? Or miss a step? Or let go of the rope? So Arjuna asks, Atakeno priyupto yam papam chariti purusha anicham api varshaya baladi vinayojita. Text 36, third chapter. O descendant of Vishnu, O Krishna, by what is one impelled to sinful acts, even unwillingly, as if engaged by force? What is it that forces one to act improperly, give up one's proper duties, and act improperly, not only improperly, but sometimes even sinfully? Even though you may know better, even though we may know better and know exactly what is the right thing to do, still, we see so many times that, at least for myself, so many times I do the wrong thing even though I know the right thing. I act improperly. We may act sinfully even though we know sinfully means sinfully, even though we know we're going to suffer. What is that force that pushes us to do the wrong thing in the face of the right thing? It's a good question. And Krishna says, Kama Asha Krodha Asha Rajaguno Samudbhava Mahashano Mahapapma Vidyanam Iyavarinam. Kama Asha. This is calm. This is desire, this Krodha Asha, this is anger, this is the force. Rajugano Samudbhava, it is born from the mode of passion. Kam comes from passion, and then when there is frustration due to passion being unsatisfied, then what is born but anger? The result is anger, which is tamagun, ignorance. So from tamagun is born of rajagun. Anger is born of unsatisfied desires, lust. Mahashano, this means it is all devouring. And you can see it. Whenever you get angry, whenever I get angry, you know, you can kill some practical people, you can kill somebody. And you can do it, you know, just in a second. The anger flares up. Out the window. second that can happen. And it's like a big raging forest fire. And then after it's over, first you have to start justifying when the anger starts subsiding. You have to start thinking why it was actually, you were just right and the person really deserved it. And then after, if you have any heart, you feel like such a fool. But of course, you've never let anyone else know. You have to explain how the other person was really wrong all the time, etc. But actually, this kama and krodha has made a complete fool out of us. Rajaguno, born out of rajaguna. They have tricked us and trapped us again. And beaten us and forced us to act. And made us completely identify, even though we don't have anything to do with the body. And see, remember, this process that we're talking about is a gradual disassociation from the body, this yoga ladder, right? Which is our identification with the body is ignorance. And what we're trying to do by the yoga ladder is gradually disassociate ourselves from the body and get real knowledge that we're not the body, but we're souls, and then even more than that, we're Krishna's servant, eternal servant. And what this kama and krodha does is force us to identify with the body. It locks us in the cage of identification with the body. And therefore, it is all-devouring. What does it devour? Any chance of spiritual elevation. Mahashano, Mahapa, it is the great sin because it forces us to ruin our human life. So that is the most sinful thing, and it will force us to do any sinful thing, every improper thing. Mahashano, Mahapa, Vidyanam, and it covers, you should know this, in the material world, this is the great enemy. We think there are so many great enemies in this world, so many enemies. But this is the enemy. Kama, krodha, born of rajaguna and tamaguna. This is the enemy. We should clearly understand this and understand we have no other enemy. And we should stop kidding ourselves, blaming everyone else and everything else. Because you're leaving? I didn't mean to insult you or anything. Okay, you can take it. But it's very difficult. This is very difficult. It takes introspection, which is born of the mode of goodness, to understand honesty, to understand that our problem is this. And it's no one else's fault. This is our problem. This is Krishna's answer to what forces one to act improperly. Next, Krishna is going to give three examples of different degrees of lust covering the soul. Covering the soul. As fire is covered by a smoke, that's the lightest covering. As mirror is covered by dust, or as the embryo is covered by the womb, the living entity is similarly covered by different degrees of this lust. So, fire covered by smoke, when there's a fire is covered by smoke, the fire is there, the heat is there, the light is there, but there's the trouble of the smoke. That is compared to more the mode of goodness. You can get some use out of the fire because the heat and the light is there, even though the smoke is troublesome. It is compared to human life. Prabhupada compares it to human life. We can get use out of it, even though the fault is there. So the covering is light, lighter, of this ignorance or lust or complete identification with the body and mind. Then the next level of covering is the mirror is covered by dust, because you can see the mirror there. When the mirror is covered by dust, you can't really use it, because you can't use the mirror for its purpose, but at least you can see where it is, you can identify, there's the mirror. You can't use it for its purpose. So that's the second degree covering. And then the third degree, the greatest degree, as the womb covers the embryo, because you cannot see the embryo in the womb, nor can it move, nor can it, does it have any use. And that is the greatest. So it's so trapped. When lust is very great in the mode of ignorance, it so covers the living entity that he is completely trapped, and practically he's not even a soul. That means practically his consciousness is no consciousness, no freedom, no anything, no chance to do anything. That's completely trapped. Three different degrees. Thus the wise living entity's pure consciousness becomes covered by his eternal enemy in the form of kamarup, lust, which is never satisfied, and it burns like fire. Now we mentioned this in a class a few days ago, how our desires are compared to a fire. Why are our desires or lust compared to a fire, a blazing fire? It consumes everything you put into it, and everything you put into it just makes it blaze more powerfully and makes it demand more fuel. So it does no good to make the attempt to satisfy our desires. That's just what Bali Maharaj was told by Vamandev. When Vamandev went to beg from Bali Maharaj, Bali Maharaj was the king of the universe, and Vamandev came and he said, I'll give you anything. And he said, okay, what do you want? Vamandev said, I want 3 paces of land. And Bali Maharaj just looked at him and said, 3 paces of land? I'm capable of giving you planets. I possess everything. What do you want? Wives, villages, gold, whatever you want, I'll give you. And you, an inexperienced boy, are asking for 3 paces of land? And Vamadeva replied, if one is not satisfied with 3 paces of land, he will not be satisfied with the entire universe. This is our nature. We have a desire, and we fulfill it, and then suddenly we find we have 4 desires. And if we fill those 4, we'll have 16. And if we fill those 16, we'll have 116. And this is the way it works. Our desires just grow and grow, and the more fuel, the more we try to satisfy them, the more they burn and blaze, and the more they want to devour us. So an intelligent person simply stops. No. I'm not going to. Why should I be such a fool and try to satisfy these desires when I know they're just going to give me trouble? But it's easy to say that, but difficult to do it. But Krishna is now going to tell, after giving us his knowledge, he's going to give us some instruction how to conquer over these lusty desires which are our enemy. Mahapapam, Mahashano. So he says, the senses, the mind, and the intelligence are the sitting places of this lust. Through them, lust covers the real knowledge of the living entity and bewilders us. So we have knowledge, especially devotees. We have knowledge, and it becomes covered. And the coverings sit in the senses, the mind, and the intelligence. Krishna is telling this because when you're fighting a war, you have to know where the enemy is strong. And then when you know where the enemy is strong, you can attack. So out of the senses, the mind, and the intelligence, Krishna is now going to recommend which one to attack first to defeat lust. Therefore, Arjuna, best of the Bharatas, in the very beginning, curb this great symbol of sin, lust, by regulating the senses and slay this destroyer of knowledge and self-realization. So regulating the senses, start on the sense platform. follow the four rules, the basic beginning. If we don't follow the four rules, no meat eating, no intoxication, and no illicit sex, and no gambling, we become bound tightly to the bodily concept of life, and we cannot make any advancement. Sometimes, in current ISKCON, the devotees have changed what the meaning of the four rules. In the dealings between husband and wife, they say that is not illicit. But that is not what Prabhupada said. Why? Because one cannot make any advancement if the husband and wife are acting together. Because one will become bound to the bodily concept of life. One cannot get out of the bodily concept of life unless one is following the four rules. We should know this and not doubt it. We should not be fooled. We should not be fooled. We should not be fooled. In other institutions even, they say there are no restrictions in the dealing between husband and wife. And they say that. And the husbands and wives in those institutions don't make any advancement. I guarantee you that. Because you can't get out of the bodily concept of life unless these four rules are followed strictly. So what Krishna is recommending, out of the mind, the intelligence, and the senses, if you want to control lust, start by controlling the senses. The mind and the intelligence, controlling the mind and the intelligence are much more difficult. And then, Krishna is leading up to his conclusion, the working senses are superior to dull matter. Mind is higher than the senses, and intelligence is still higher than the mind, and he, the soul, is even higher than the intelligence. And here's one of my favorite verses in the Bhagavad Gita. Thus, evam buddhi param buddha samstabhya paparamara jahi shatram kama rupa virasana. Thus, by knowing oneself transcendental to the material senses, mind, and intelligence, O Mari Om Dojun, one should steady the mind and thereby steady the intelligence by steadying the senses by deliberate spiritual intelligence, Krishna consciousness, and thus by spiritual strength, kanka, the insatiable enemy known as lust. In other words, you study Bhagavad Gita and become so fixed in this knowledge, and we should get our intelligence so strong and fixed, because the Bhagavad Gita is not written on the spiritual platform. It is written on the intellectual platform. So using the intelligence, using this jnana, this upajnana, knowledge about Krishna and how things work in the material world, we should, with that strength of intelligence, control our mind and thereby control our senses. But our intelligence must become fixed up in Krishna consciousness. And therefore we must study the philosophy. If we don't study the philosophy, our mind and senses will be carried away. We must surrender in this way. Study the philosophy. Become fixed up. When we say fixed up, it means the intelligence fixed up on the Bhagavad Gita platform, and thereby control the mind and control the senses. And fight this insatiable enemy known as lust. Insatiable means it cannot be satisfied. There is no way to fight it by giving in. It has to be fought by first regulating the senses. Sometimes we follow the four rules and our mind is desiring so many things. But the answer is to fix the intelligence, to put more pressure on the mind. Through the intelligence. Not exactly bhakti, but it's the use of the best thing a human being has, is intelligence, to make progress in spiritual life. This is Bhagavad Gita. It will give us all the equipment, all the weapons to fight with Maya. Krishna has come as Shiksha Guru in the form of Bhagavad Gita. Instruct us how to get out of the material world in this way and not be misled off the path. And this, I read a conversation with Prabhupada a few days ago where Prabhupada said, I notice in your country, meaning the United States, the devotees are losing their enthusiasm to spread this movement. This means they are not following the four rules. Because when lust enters, spiritual intelligence is lost. So don't doubt this. Know what we have to do. I just want to read something from Manashiksha. Oh, you brought the wrong book. I said the little book, this big. This was in the wrong, I said by the lotus. Well, you brought the wrong book. That's why. Now, when our intelligence isn't so strong, and when our mind becomes so full of desires, not only the Sanskrit word used is kam, so that really means any desires that take us away from our duty to go forward in Krishna consciousness. So when our mind becomes strong and is pulling us away from Krishna consciousness, and it's so raging like the wind, and we're going to talk about this maybe in the next class, controlling the mind as per this. No, a few classes. What do we do? Sometimes the mind becomes so heavy and so powerful and we identify with it so much that we cannot invoke our intelligence to control it. So what do we do? So Raghunath Das Goswami tells us what to do. My dear mind, he says, this is his prayer. In this material life, you are attacked by lust, which is like a gang of dacoits, thugs that we waylay innocent pilgrims. Sometimes, even when Bhakti Vrindavan's always been famous for his dacoits and gundas. And even when Bhakti Vinod Thakur came to Vrindavan, there were so many dacoits around. And he went back and he ended up using his incredible potency and influence, he removed them. But what happens is they would attack a pilgrim. A pilgrim is going on a spiritual journey. And these dacoits would come and attack them and take any wealth they had by force. So one has attained some wealth by his hard work. And then one feels so miserable actually when his wealth is taken away. But even more valuable than any material wealth is our spiritual wealth that we've gained. Who knows how many lives, how many births it's taken to bring us to the Krishna consciousness movement, to bring us to Vrindavan. And then the dacoits or gundas, thugs, robbers of lust attack us and try to take away all our spiritual wealth that we've gained by so much hard work. And they will take everything. Lust will take everything. Material desires will take everything. And we are sure to be attacked on our spiritual quest. So Raghunath Das Goswami is comparing lust to dacoits. They will strangle you with strong, terrible ropes of pain, distress, and useless endeavors. In this condition, when you are attacked, you should cry out piteously and invoke the mercy of the unalloyed devotees of Lord Krishna, the killer of the demon Bakasura. They surely will protect you from this dilemma. So if you become attacked, you have to call out, Krishna, Krishna, oh Prabhupada, oh Guru Maharaj. Immediately, when the mind becomes becomes infected by anger, by lust, by material desires, we have to call out for help. Immediately, even we have to have this much detachment from our mind and this much intelligence to call out very loudly and immediately, just like when if some dacoits come and you call out, police, police, police. Of course, it's usually the police that are the dacoits. But take that off the tape. But then immediately they become afraid and run. So sometimes when a robber attacks you, the first thing moves. So you can't call out. But the devotees, they have at least this sincere we have to be, and at least this separate from our mind's desires. We have to call out the help of all. There's so many saintly devotees, so many great acharyas, so many powerful personalities. Any of them, all of them will help us, but we have to call out to them piteously. Piteously means I have no one else but you to help me. If we call out, if our mind becomes infected with some material desires and we say, oh Prabhupada, help me. Oh, Krishna. So nice. Meanwhile, you're watching television or something like that. Oh, Prabhupada, help me. Or something. No, we have to be that sincere to call out piteously, really, that we want help. Even just for 1 second, and we'll get help. There are other things we can say about karma. But without sincerity, nothing will work. Honesty and sincerity. To piteously call out, you have to feel helpless. And to feel helpless, you have to be honest. And sincere and humble. And if we have those, and if we become beggars, in that way, beg for help, we will never be let down. Never, ever, ever. But our problem is lack of sincerity. We hide so many little secret desires in our heart. So we have to not want them. Or when they come up in our heart, we have to say, I don't want this. I don't want this. Krishna, no. No. Okay, Vaishnavas, no. We can't pour water on these weeds. We can't give them the time and the attention in our heart. Unless we want them to grow stronger. And also another thing we can do, if we become angry, we can laugh. Because anger and laughter cannot go on at the same time. And I know that sometimes if you're really angry, and if someone makes you laugh, you want to kill them even more, because you don't want to be laughed, you don't want to get out, you want to be angry. And you know that laughing has the force to pull you out, so you become angry with that person. Okay, question?
You were saying how it's the desire of the living entity that brings all of those reactions. So Prabhupada, he says that that we only have the independence to accept whether we want to follow a spiritual or material authority, either we choose Krishna or we choose the modes or whatever. And if you're working out of the modes, then how much of a free desire do you really have?
It depends which mode you're working on. Depends how thick the covering of lust is. If you're in the mode of goodness, you have more freedom.